This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Last week we spoke about the anomaly of Purim, how unusual Purim is as a festival on our calendar. Our holidays tend to be solemn and meaningful and serious, and Purim tends to be frivolous and fun. And at the same time, last week we spoke about the fact that Purim fits into the larger framework of the holidays, which is to say all the holidays, beginning with those commemorating the Exodus, the pilgrim festivals, the Regalim, and continuing through the Tzomot and Purim and Chanukah, all of them really address the larger issue, which is how do the Jewish people navigate human history when human history is dominated by empires that are much powerful than we are, and sometimes those empires are sympathetic and often they are hostile. And if we look at Purim through that lens, clearly Purim fits into the larger fabric of Jewish tradition. So I guess, you know, what we were left with after all was said and done is an ambivalence about Purim, and it's an ambivalence that finds expression in the rabbinic sources as well. If you remember last week, we talked about the Gemara and Megillah, where Rabbi Yehoshua maintained that the Megillah does not belong in the Hebrew Bible, does not have sanctity as some sort of canonical text. And Shmuel, who followed him about a century or so later, two centuries later, and now we're talking about the third century CE, Shmuel, who's an Amora, says, yes, the telling of the story, of course, has significance, Ruach HaKodesh, as it were, but not the text. That's not the view that's adopted in terms of Jewish tradition. In terms of Jewish tradition, obviously, the Megillah becomes part of the Hebrew Bible and becomes canonical and is charged with having sacredness. But at the same time, as I expressed last week, there's a certain ambivalence in all of this discussion. You know, I'm sure it has to do with how we celebrate Purim. It has to do with the nature of the festival. It also has to do with the Megillah itself. And the most glaring omission of all, which I pointed out last week, and with this we ended, which is the glaring omission of God's name in the story. God's name, unlike any other book in the Hebrew Bible, which puts God front and center. There's no such thing as a biblical book that doesn't focus our attention on God. And yet Megillat Esther tells a story seemingly shorn of any sort of divine involvement or intervention. One could explain the events of the Megillah, as we will see, as purely the product of ambitious individuals, political intrigue. Everything would make sense in the story. There's no need whatsoever to involve God. And in fact, God is not mentioned in the Megillah at all. And I'm sure this is part of the ambivalence that colors rabbinic discussion of the matter. Last week, we ended with the commentary of Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra wanted to argue that the reason why God is omitted from the Megillah, and you have it on last week's source sheets if you still have those, the very end, Ibn Ezra wanted to say, because Mordechai and Esther knew that, of course, the story would be recorded in the annals of the Persian kings. The Megillah tells us as much. And when that record would take place, the Persians, who would be telling their version of the story, would be substituting God's name with the name of one of their own deities, or maybe several of their deities. And I'm just going to read a little bit of that. Hem hayu avdei avodah zarah. They, of course, the Persians were idolaters. You don't have this in front of you unless you have last week's sources at the end. Vahayu kotvin tachat Hashem hanichbad vahanora shem to avotam. And therefore they would have substituted the awesome name of God with a name of one of their idolatrous deities. And therefore, kivod Hashem, shelo yizkerenu Mordechai b'Megillah, it actually is glory to God for his name to be omitted. So this is obviously an attempt to explain the inexplicable. Why is it that God's name is omitted from the Megillah? Ibn Ezra wants to suggest it's in order, as it were, to protect God's glory, because when that text is translated into Persian, the Persian version that rhymes, by those that are going to be doing that work who will not be Jewish, so clearly they will be substituting God's name with something else. And I pointed out last time, this is not an unfound fear. Ibn Ezra was well aware that even as the Tanakh was translated into different languages by peoples that were not Jewish, but took the scriptures as somehow their own, clearly there's something that happens, an agenda-driven translation, and the story becomes changed. Okay, so that's Ibn Ezra's theory. This evening I want to begin with a modern theory, a different one, that addresses the same issue, and it seems like anybody who is studying the Megillah is consumed with this issue. Why is God's name omitted? Why is the story so devoid of divine involvement? Why is the holiday so unlike any other holiday on the Jewish calendar? So I want to present a theory of Dr. Adele Berlin. And Adele Berlin, for many years, was the chair of Jewish studies at Maryland. And she's a biblical scholar, an accomplished biblical scholar. And her theory is the following. Basically, she says, and here's the fancy word to describe the whole thing, that the Megillah is an etiology. What does an etiology mean? If you're a doctor, so the etiology is explanation for the origin of the medical condition. Whatever the medical condition is, we got to find the source, we got to find the origin, and we have to describe it. How we got to that place of the medical condition? Well, we go back and we describe the source of it. And in a literary sense, an etiology means an origin story, which is to say we have a situation which already exists, and the purpose of the text is to explain how it is that that situation came about. So her theory is that the Jewish people in Persia are celebrating something called carnival, and carnival looks suspiciously like Purim does. Okay? Basically, what's involved in any carnival, just think Mardi Gras or whatever it is, people dress up in costume, they go out into the streets, they engage in a little bit of mock violence, they get drunk, they have fun, it's boisterous, it's over the top, and it's some sort of a safety valve that allows human societies to kind of vent their, you know, need for violence in a less destructive way. That's what carnival is. And she wants to suggest that essentially the Jewish people, like every other ancient culture, are celebrating carnival. But you know and I know that carnival and Jewish tradition don't sort of go hand in hand. Ah, so how do we turn carnival into a religiously acceptable activity? We give it an origin story called Megillat Esther. So Megillat Esther, according to her theory, is an attempt to explain, to justify, to rationalize, to endorse the practice of carnival among the Jewish people and give it some sort of a religious significance. Right? And she's careful to explain, don't think for a moment that the story of the Megillah actually took place. It's just historical fiction. And therefore, any sort of interpretive questions that are vexing or difficult don't really exist. You can't really, there's no need to explain historical fiction. There's no need to explain comedy. That's all the Megillah really is. Now, of course, there's a takeaway message, which is the survival of the Jewish people, and that's meaningful, and that's profound, but fundamentally, according to her argument, Megillat Esther is not really the story of Purim. It's more like Purim exists in carnival form, and Megillat Esther is created in order to explain it. So, according to that theory, of course, why would we ever expect God's name to be in there in the first place? The whole thing is just an attempt to explain a practice which in any other context would not be congruous with religious sensitivity. So therefore, she argues, Megillat Esther is basically a myth, as it were. And even though I know the author of Megillat Esther will claim that the story is recorded in the annals of the Persian kings, but every good author of historical fiction would have done the same. If you want people to believe the story, then you tell them, guess what, everybody? This story is true. It's recorded in the official history. Of course, she maintains that the author of Megillat Esther does have a keen awareness of how the Persian Empire works. So she ascribes the period of composition to be the period of the Persian Empire. And therefore, the author knows very well that the Persian court is characterized by drunkenness. It's characterized by feasting. The Persian bureaucracy has a wonderful postal system, right, that allows the mail to reach the far ends of the empire. And the Persians are given to banquets and wine. And all that stuff is true. But that doesn't make the story true. That's her argument. It just means that somebody who knows about how the Persian court functions has written a story with that knowledge in order to explain why it is that the Jewish people are participating in carnival. So that's called an etiology. That's her theory. Okay, so the theory obviously would explain why it is that God's name is omitted. It would explain why Purim is celebrated the way that it's celebrated. But there's no need to search for a deeper interpretation according to this theory, because there isn't one. It's simply an attempt to explain why it is that the Jewish people are participating in carnival, just like everybody else's, but to give it some sort of a religious definition. Okay, so that's one theory, and obviously it's in glaring contrast to Ibn Ezra, and yet it's not. Ibn Ezra also is speaking about idolatry as being some sort of an issue at the basis of the story. So they're coming from very, very different places. I'm not sure that they're arriving at very, very different conclusions, except, of course, that for Ibn Ezra, the story is, as it were, divine inspiration. The story is, as it were, a true account. But fundamentally, Ibn Ezra and Adele Berlin, in as much as the omission of God's name from the story, pretty much are on the same wavelength. Okay? So that's one theory. Another theory as to why Purim is what it is and why God's name is not mentioned. I'd like to offer a different theory, a contemporary one as well, this time by Menachem Liebtag, who's a contemporary Bible scholar. And in contrast to Adele Berlin, who argues that the Megillah is a comedy or a farce, Menachem Liebtag will argue that the Megillah is a satire. What does a satire mean? It can be funny. It can be amusing. But it's also a social commentary. It's a critique. The Megillah, says Menachem, is a critique of something. What is it a critique of? Well, let's see. In the Megillah, Shushan is very prominent in the story and the events that take place in Shushan. In the Megillah, the palace of Ahasuerus is a very, very significant location. And so much of the action happens in the palace. In the Megillah, the Persian Empire is absolutely the central issue that affects the story. And Menachem basically argues what happened in the Megillah tragically was that the Jewish community in Persia celebrated Shushan and celebrated the palace and celebrated the Persian Empire, and along the way they forgot some really important things. What did they forget? They forgot that there's a city called Jerusalem. They forgot that there's something called the temple. They forgot that there's something called Jewish identity. And the critique, according to Menachem, which is a very harsh one, is a critique of, as it were, Persian Jewry, where Persian Jewry has basically involved themselves in the larger cultural context to the degree that what should be important and fundamental to their identity as Jewish people has been completely forgotten. So therefore, the events of the Megillah, which happen in about 450 BCE, they are taking place after the temple has been rebuilt. They're taking place after the people have returned to Jerusalem. And of course, the question is, why is there a community of Persian Jews at all? Why did they remain behind? Why didn't they pick themselves up when the opportunity arose and return to Jerusalem in order to rebuild the temple? And the answer is, because they were so enmeshed in Persian culture that leaving all of that stuff behind was impossible. You can see where this theory is going, right? Obviously, for him, it does have contemporary relevance. This is the perennial story of diaspora Jewry. When opportunities arise for the Jewish people to take initiative and reclaim their sovereignty, how many are prepared to do so? And the contemporary answer is, present company excluded, most Jews who are in the state of Israel today got here not because they wanted to, but because they were forced to. And that was certainly the case in the earlier version of the story, which is a story of Shivat Zion, the restoration to Zion. The people that came back to the land of Israel to rebuild the temple, to rebuild Jerusalem, tended to be the people who had nothing to lose. Those that had a lot to lose remained in Babylon and remained in Persia and built those communities up. And those that had nothing to lose, the schleppers, if you will, they were the ones who made their way to Jerusalem. That's why I said present company excluded. Because I think the people in this room actually had an opportunity that most Jews, diaspora Jews, never realized. Which is that we came here because we wanted to, not because we had to. But that's not his point. His point is the Jews remain in Persia. They turn Shushan into their Jerusalem. They turn the palace into their temple. And they turn Ahasuerus into their god, so to speak. And therefore a scene like chapter 5 of Megillat Esther is no longer unintelligible. In chapter 5 of Megillat Esther, if you remember, Ahasuerus sits on his throne in what's called HaChatzar HaPenimit, the inner courtyard. And Esther makes her approach with trepidation from the outer courtyard to the inner courtyard in order to be in the presence of the king. But to arrive unannounced is a capital offense. That should all ring a bell. That's called the service of the high priest on Yom Kippur. The high priest enters into the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh HaKodashim, the Chatzar HaPenimit. He does so by first passing through an intermediate zone called the Kodesh. You cannot enter into the presence of God unannounced, and you take your life into your hands. So as it were, the Purim story, even as it describes the events in Persia, is satirizing what it is that the Jews surrendered as a function of their attachment to Persian life and to Persian culture. And therefore, the omission of God's name is readily comprehensible. That's the whole problem, that the Jews forgot that God should be at the center of the story. That's the whole problem, that the Jews forgot that Shushan was not their home and Persia wasn't their native culture. That's the whole problem, that the Jews forgot that the temple rises in Jerusalem and they are thousands, hundreds of kilometers away. So it's actually an indictment of Jewish life in the diaspora. That's Megillat Esther. Now, of course, we have heroic figures called Mordechai and Esther, but let's not forget that even those names are suspiciously, how shall I put it, goyish, okay? Which is to say, the name Mordechai is actually very good, a variation of Marduk. Marduk is the head of the Babylonian pantheon. And Esther sounds suspiciously like Astarte. Astarte is a very popular deity in the region. She's a female goddess. Sometimes she's Aphrodite. That's the Greek version. Sometimes she's Venus. That's the Roman version. It's all the same. Okay? The word star, by the way, comes from the name of that goddess. Okay, so his claim is, yeah, they have Goyish names, so to speak, because that's the point of the story. Jewish identity has been thrown to the wind. And the Jews survive as a diaspora community, shorn of sovereign power. What does that look like? You are subject to the whims of the Persian king. Or as Rava would have put it in the Gemara, Akate avde Achashverosh anan. We're still the servants, the slaves of Achashverosh. That situation doesn't change. Okay? So therefore, rather than comedy, as Adele Berlin would have it, this is more like tragedy. Rather than some sort of farce, this is a harsh indictment of Jewish life in Persia in the 5th century BCE. Okay, so that's the theory. Both of them are working with the same data, which is to say, the unusual features of the holiday and the omission of God's name. And like any good interpretive disagreement, they arrive at diametrically different interpretations. Okay? I'd like to suggest a different way of looking at the situation, a different way of looking at the story. And in order to do so, we're going to be following the narrative events. So if you have your source sheet, it's on page 3. That's where it begins. And what I did here was carefully catalog the narrative events of the Megillah in order. And when one does so, I would recommend, like, methodologically, it's a very, very useful tool to outline the story. Because that way, you don't lose track of the critical details. That way, you begin to see interconnections that perhaps are not obvious when you don't create an outline of the whole. And in this little outline, what I've done basically is catalog the events of the story. The number in brackets is the number of the chapter in the Megillah that corresponds to the event. The number of the year is the year of Achashverosh's reign as the story unfolds in the Megillah, which is to say the story begins in the 3rd year of his reign, and we hear events that happen in that year as well as in the 7th year, but most of the focus of the story is actually the 12th year of Achashverosh's reign. That's where most of the action is. Pretty much from chapter 3 of the Megillah through chapter 9, all of that happens in the 12th year of Achashverosh's reign. So let's quickly run through the events, and I want to note a few things along the way as we make our way. Okay, in the 3rd year of his reign, Achashverosh holds a feast. The Megillah does not tell us why he holds a feast, but it's for 180 days, which is, of course, unprecedented. There are no feasts in the Hebrew Bible that last. Can you imagine Pesach for 180 days, folks? It's like overwhelming, okay? So in the 3rd year, there's a feast for 180 days. It is held for the ministers and the servants of the king. Sarav v'avadav, ministers and servants. At the conclusion of those 180 days, there's a 7-day feast which is held for the people of Shushan. Okay, so basically it's 187 days. During this 7-day feast, Vashti the queen holds her own feast for the women. It's at the conclusion of that 7-day feast that the king demands that she appear before him in the presence of everyone else in order to display her beauty. Okay, and of course that's the trigger for Vashti being deposed because she refuses. That's the trigger ultimately for Esther becoming queen a little bit later in the story. So I want people to sort of note that it's almost as if the clock is ticking. 180 days pass uneventfully. 7 days pass uneventfully. The climactic display of his power, the pyrotechnics, is to present Vashti on the seventh day at the very end of this lavish feasting, and she refuses. Which is to say, it's almost as if the story has been constructed with dramatic artifice to bring us to a moment of tremendous expectation, and then to have it dashed when she refuses. That would have been the effect in real time. And so she's deposed. Okay? And the king goes on a hunt for a new queen. And it's not until the seventh year that a new queen is selected, which is to say Esther. Now just sort of imagine what that means. Right? The king is going through the women of the realm left and right in search of this new queen. I want to say this delicately, but it's not a beauty pageant, even though we tend to tell our kids, our grandkids, isn't it wonderful to dress up as Queen Esther and the rest of it? It's more like state-sanctioned rape. That's really what it is. The king is gathering women from all over the empire. And by the way, the text reports, Esther does not volunteer for the position. Vatilakach Esther el hamelech Achashverosh. She is taken, like all the other women are. And this goes on for 4 years. Okay? So that's a lot of state resources being devoted to this personal project of, you know, finding the next queen and the rest of it. And she'll be coronated as queen with a feast in her honor in the seventh year. And basically, what I didn't report was that, of course, Mordechai made his appearance somewhere in that interim as well. Okay? But Esther basically is going to be queen for 5 years before Haman is introduced officially. Okay? If I were to construct a profile of Achashverosh, I would say clearly this is a guy who suffers from a self-esteem problem, a self-worth problem. Okay? He's got to impress everybody, or otherwise he feels like nothing. Clearly, this is a guy that suffers from paranoia, which is why he needs a Haman to keep things under control, especially after that little assassination attempt that Mordechai foils and reports to Esther, who reports it to the king, and the assassins are put to death, and the events are recorded in the chronicles and promptly forgotten. Okay? So it's really the 12th year, which is the beginning of our story. And in the 12th year, Haman is elected. And at first he doesn't notice that Mordechai refuses to bow. We don't know why Mordechai refuses to bow, by the way. It's one of those moments in the story where if the author wanted to be a little more religious, he would have made it obvious, or she, right? I.e., when Daniel refuses to bow down to the golden image set up by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, the book of Daniel will tell us exactly why. Because he's a devotee of God, and devotees of God don't worship idols. And yet all of that is absent from our version of the story. We don't know why Mordechai refuses to bow. Is he being religious, or is he being political? Okay. In any case, Haman doesn't notice until it's pointed out to him by the other servants of the king. And once he notices, he is enraged. Okay. So in the first month, the month of Nisan, he will cast lots, Purim, Pur, right? The inspiration for the name of the holiday, in order to determine the best date for destroying not only Mordechai, but Mordechai's people. What will that date be? The 13th of Adar, which is the 12th month. Okay? So good news there. I'll just point it out in case you didn't notice. That basically gives Mordechai, Esther, the Jews, about a year to deal with the fallout. Right? If the lot would have fallen on the second month or the third month, they would have been in a lot more trouble. But basically, they have from the first month, the month of Nisan, until the 12th month, the month of Adar, to deal with the issue, to respond, to react, to prepare, to plan. Okay, now the truth is, by the time the 13th of Adar rolls around next year, Haman will already be long gone. Okay, he's dead by the third month, the month of Sivan. Okay, so there's a lot of action which happens in this 12th year, but it's compressed into the story of the Megillah. Should we go through the dates really quick? Yeah? Is that helpful? Okay, so really quickly, in the first month, as I said, Haman will throw the lots, and the day of destruction will be designated as the 13th day of Adar. And again, I'm on page 3. And on the 13th of Nisan, okay, the 13th of Nisan, we call that, by the way, the day before Bidikat Chametz, right, the 13th of Nisan. The scribes will be summoned, and the messengers will be dispatched with the decree that the Jews are to be destroyed. So that's another way of saying Haman isn't wasting any time. Okay, he feels that the momentum is on his side. He casts those lots in the first month. I don't know exactly what day. But by the 13th day of Nisan, it's a done deal, so to speak. The decree of destruction has been publicized throughout the empire. Okay? In the meantime, Mordechai will obviously find out. And he will publicly mourn and fast. And wherever the news reaches the Jews, they will do the same. And then he will send a message to Esther. And she, by the way, is blissfully unaware of any of this. What does that tell you? That being the queen does not mean to have any political role whatsoever. She's basically in the harem, separated from the events and the intrigue in the palace, separated from Shushan, separated from the empire, and has no clue what's going on. So Mordechai will tell her what's going on. There's been a decree pronounced against your people. Do something. And she hesitates. What do you mean, do something? If I approach the king unannounced, it's a capital offense. And by the way, that whole conversation happens indirectly. Mordechai can't reach Esther. She's in the harem. He's outside. It all happens through messengers. Okay, a messenger in particular by the name of Hatach, who communicates Mordechai's message to Esther and Esther's message back to him. Okay, now that changes the whole nature of the conversation. It's not sort of like this heated moment where the fate of the Jewish people hangs in the balance and Mordechai convinces Esther face to face to do something. It's all happening indirectly, which means she could just as easily refuse, right? So there's an opportunity there for her to think, to reflect, to decide how to proceed, and in the end, to acquiesce to Mordechai's demand. I will do it, but only if you will declare a fast for 3 days, I guess to tip the balance in our favor, such that when I approach the king, I have a fighting chance. Okay, and she will approach the king and invite him to a feast along with Haman. And at that feast, she will invite them to a second feast. And in between those two feasts, the king's sleep is disturbed. Okay? Balayla hahu nadida shnat hamelech. And of course, we all understand, what does that mean? The king's sleep is disturbed. Isn't just Ahasuerus' sleep being disturbed, but as it were, the divine king's sleep is disturbed as well, because now God will, this is the typical argument, God will intervene in the story in order to change the trajectory. And in fact, the trajectory is changed. Okay? Because at the second feast, Esther will reveal Haman to be the villain that he is. And as he pleads for his life in this dramatic moment, the king will misinterpret that as an attempt at seducing the queen. Of course, for Adele Berlin, that's sort of the whole comic nature of the story. Right? But that will lead to Haman being deposed. And all of this happens, like I said, pretty quickly after the events of Nisan. Esther will reveal her identity. She'll reveal her connection to Mordechai. And they will win approval to send messages to the Jews in the realm that the Jews are allowed to defend themselves. And those messages will be sent on the 23rd day of Sivan. Okay? The third month. And as I said, right, Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, by this point, Haman is already dead. He's been hanged. Okay? So the messages will be sent. The Jews can defend themselves. And now they will wait with trepidation for the 13th day of Adar as the time ticks down. Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av, Elul, Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, Tevet, Shvat, Adar. I didn't learn that till high school, by the way, the names of the months in order. But it's really useful. Okay? So in any case, right, there's lots of time to prepare, but there's also lots of time to be anxious. And when the 13th day of Adar rolls around, the Jews will defend themselves, and you know the rest of the story. Okay? So what's my point? I guess my point is, first of all, most of the narrative events of the Megillah are compressed into a very small time frame, even though textually they take up most of the story. So there's not a lot to report from the third year until the 12th year. Most of the reporting is within the 12th year. And even within that 12th year, it's really just a small series of events that are focused upon. That's one point. Another point that I want people to note is in the Megillah, we have some sort of an unusual feature to add to all the other unusual features, which is in the Megillah, we have two ways to designate the Hebrew month. It's a number, the first month, the second month, the third month, the 12th month, and it's a name, Nisan, Sivan, Adar, etc. Okay? That typically doesn't happen in biblical books. In biblical books, by and large, we only employ this system, i.e., the Hebrew months have names. Sorry, the Hebrew months have numbers. The first month, the second month, the third month, the fourth month. They don't have any names until later in Jewish history. The Hebrew books of the Bible that are post-exilic, which is to say, those that describe the story of the Jewish people after the destruction of the first temple, after the return to Zion, those are the ones that begin to incorporate different terms for the months of the year. The month of Nisan, the month of Sivan, the month of Adar. Okay? What's the difference between the two systems? The first month, the second month, the third month, etc., those are called ordinal numbers, right? Because they reference a particular point in time that serves as the core for the numbering. If I would say 1, 2, 3, those are cardinal numbers. But if I say first, second, third, I'm obviously referencing something. What am I referencing? HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, Rosh Chodashim. The Exodus. The first month from the Exodus, the second month from the Exodus, etc. It's very similar to the days of the week in Hebrew. The first day, the second day, the third day, the fourth day, etc. They don't have any other names. What does it mean, the first day, the second day, the third day, the fourth? In reference to Shabbat. That's the reference point. Okay, so that's true of all of the books of the Hebrew Bible up until that point of the temple being destroyed and the Jewish people being exiled. And from that point onwards, which is to say, the book of Daniel, the book of Ezra, the book of Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah, Megillat Esther. Those are the books, the only books in which we find this other system where the months of the year have names. Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz. And by the way, those names sound suspiciously non-Jewish, which they are. And I'll give you just one example, okay, which is the month of Tammuz. Okay. Tammuz is actually a Mesopotamian vegetation god. And he's born in the springtime after the rains. And he is vigorous and vital. Late spring, early summer. And as summer drags on, the life is drained from him. And the vegetation turns brown. And the earth dries up. And Nebuch, Tammuz, dies. But not to worry, because he's going to be revived by the winter rains. Okay? The myth of Tammuz is one of the most popular resurrection stories which is told in this region of the world in ancient times. That's why Tammuz is a summer month, because it's actually a Babylonian god. Which is, of course, shocking in a way. Why are we talking about Babylonian gods in terms of keeping time on the Jewish calendar? I'll tell you what's even more shocking. I'm sure you've met those people that will say, oh no, I would never write January, February, or March on a check. That's goyish. I use the Hebrew months, Tammuz, Iyar, Sivan. Little do they know that Tammuz is actually an idol. Okay? The myth of Tammuz is an idolatrous mythology. But that's one of the ironies of Jewish life. Okay. Point I'm trying to make is Megillat Esther actually represents the transition as we move from the old system to the new system, which is why it's not simply the first month, which is the month of Nisan, the third month, which is the month of Sivan, the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. That means that the old school people who just know the old system will be familiar with it. And the new school people that just know the new system will be familiar with that as well. This is the transition moment. It's like when I was growing up in Canada in the 70s and the 80s, I was at the transition moment of what? As we move from the imperial system to the metric system. So I'm comfortable in miles and inches, and I'm comfortable in kilometers and meters. And by the heck, what's a liter anyways, right? It's a container of milk, basically, okay, for those Americans. But the point is this, right? If you merit to live at a transition moment, then you're comfortable in both systems. And Megillat Esther is telling the reader, this is the moment when we make that transition. I want to come back to this point because for the Ramban, I would say, it holds the key to understanding the Megillah. But before we get to that, I want to point out another feature that only emerges when you do a careful outline of the narrative events. And that's the following. Where's my eraser? Okay. You'll note it. What time is it already? Okay, we got time. You'll note it on your outline. Okay. Basically, the Megillah begins, as I said, with a 180-day feast, followed by a 7-day feast, followed by, or simultaneous with, a feast which is held by Vashti. Okay, like I said, at the end of all that, she's going to be deposed. This is all the third-year events. In the 7th year, Esther will be selected. Okay? And the king will hold a feast in her honor to celebrate her coronation. In chapter 3 of the Megillah, Haman will be appointed to a position of prominence. He'll have his run-ins with Mordechai. He'll decide to destroy the Jewish people. He'll get the permission of the king. V'hamelech v'haman yashvu lishtot. At the end of chapter 3. V'ha'ir Shushan Navocha. So there will be a feast of Haman and the king, during which he will celebrate, I suppose, the fact that he's won the king's approval for destroying the people of Israel. Okay? And then, of course, Mordechai will fly into his, you know, mourning fit and the rest of it, and will tell Esther she's got to do something, which she will. And she will hold two feasts of her own. And at those feasts, she will invite the king and Haman. And as I said, in between those two feasts, they're only separated by the night. The king's sleep will be disturbed. That's chapter 6. And as Haman enters the next morning to request Mordechai's execution on the gallows, the king will just have finished reading the account of the chronicles describing how Mordechai had saved his life years earlier. Okay? And then Haman's desire to be rewarded and to have Mordechai executed will be reversed, v'nahafochu, and instead Mordechai will be rewarded, and Haman won't. And he'll go home in a terrible fit of rage, and his wife and his confidants will tell him it's all lost. And from there, he's quickly taken to the second feast, where he will be exposed as the villain of Esther, right? And one thing leads to another. Like I said, he's going to be executed and hanged on those gallows that he prepared for Mordechai. When all of that happens, Mordechai will go out into the city of Shushan. V'ha'ir Shushan sahala v'samecha. And the Jews hold a feast of their own, even though it's a little premature, to celebrate the fact that Haman has been deposed. And eventually, the 13th of Adar will roll around the next year, like I said. The Jews will fight for their lives in Shushan and in the realm. And there will be two feasts that are held at the end of the Megillah to mark their triumph over their enemies. Okay? One feast will be for the Jews of the realm, and one feast will be for the Jews of Shushan. In the realm at large, they will celebrate on the 14th of Adar, and in Shushan, on the 15th of Adar, and that's why we have 2 days of Purim. Okay, now if you look at this carefully, you notice a number of features. Number one, it seems as if in the story, feasts tend to go in pairs. Right, so these feasts are related, and these feasts are related, and these feasts are related. That's one feature. Another feature that emerges is a bracketing effect. The Megillah begins with feasts for far and wide, i.e., those that are close to the king, and those that are in the city of Shushan farther out in outlying areas, and it ends in a similar fashion. The Jews that are far away, and the Jews that are close. So feasts for the far, feasts for the close, feasts for the far, feasts for the close. Okay? And all of this is, of course, mishte. And now we understand, I think, why it is that feasting is so central to the observance of Purim. And it's not necessarily what Adele Berlin is suggesting, that this is an ideology or a fabricated tale that comes to justify carnival. Actually, if we look at the story, it's clear why feasting is central to Purim. Because every significant narrative event in the story is precipitated by or marked by a mishteh. So it's obvious why Purim is about mishteh. You cannot possibly understand Purim without experiencing mishteh. Because mishteh is truly the essence of the story. Every significant moment is mishteh. Every turning point is mishteh. Every pivot point is mishteh. Every engine which drives the plot forward is mishteh. It's truly essential to the celebration of Purim. which is why I would argue there are 10 of them. Now, I'm not going to argue it's like the Ten Commandments here, 5 and 5, but I am going to argue that the number 10 as a biblical motif always points to a complete unit of something. That's what the number 10 means. There's a reason why there's 10 commandments and not 9 or 11 or 15 like in the Mel Brooks version, right? There's a reason for that. Because 10 means a complete unit. A complete unit of what? A complete unit of guiding principles. That's what the 10, they're not even the 10 commandments in Jewish tradition. They're the 10 dibrot, the 10 utterances. The 10 foundation principles. Those that pertain to God, those that pertain to other people. And the number 10 makes its appearance in the Hebrew Bible in all sorts of places, always with the same effect. 10 is a complete unit. The 10 generations from Adam to Noah, from Noah to Abraham, complete units of time, historical epochs. The 10 trials of Abraham Avinu, that's a rabbinic formulation. Same idea, a complete unit of the development of trust in God. Okay, so the number 10, as it is for us, because we happen to have 10 fingers on 2 hands, that's how we came up with this idea that 10 means a complete unit of something. The number 10 appears in the Megillah, not explicitly, because nothing is explicit here, but it's embedded in the bedrock of the story. There are 10 feasts. Okay? Now, there's also something else in the Megillah, which I would argue is, at first glance, in complete opposition to the feast idea, but also the true pivot point of the story. And again, when we talk about pivot points in the story, we could talk about many moments. Maybe the pivot point is Vashti being deposed, or maybe the pivot point is Esther being coronated, or maybe the pivot point is Mordechai refusing to bow down, or maybe it's Mordechai reporting on the assassins, or maybe it's the king's sleep being disturbed, or maybe it's Esther's first feast or her second. There's multiple pivot points in the story, which is another way of saying the story is very carefully constructed as a series of events that are intertwined fundamentally such that you cannot get from one to the other unless you've already gone through the previous one. Each event is critical for the unfolding of the plot. That's my point. And each one of those events, which is critical for the unfolding of the plot, is tied to a mishteh. And that's why Mishteh is at the center of the observance of Purim. Okay? But there's something else which happens within the story. And as luck would have it, quote unquote, it happens right in the middle of these feasts. In between number 5, Haman ascendant, and number 6, Haman in the process of being cut down to size, there's the antithesis of a mishteh. What happens in between? The fast. Okay, so it actually works out quite well in English. You got the feasts, and you got the fast. Okay, you got 5 feasts before the fast, and 5 feasts after the fast. And just try saying that 5 times fast, right? It's going to be hard. So point is, right over here, after Haman and the king sit down, v'hamelech v'haman yashvu lishtot v'ha'ir shushan navocha, Mordechai hears about the decree, and he dons sak v'efer, sackcloth and ashes and the rest of it, and he will prevail upon Esther to approach the king unannounced, and she will only agree to do so after a 3-day fast. Lech kenos et kol ha-yehudim, v'tsumu alai, v'al tochlu v'al tishtu shloshet yamim, gamani v'na'arotai natsum ken. Okay? So, right in the center of the feasts which break out in the Megillah, left and right, beginning and end, there is the tzom. Now, of course, a tzom experientially is the opposite of a feast, right? It's everything that a feast isn't. as we know. What's the significance of introducing a tzom in the center of all of the Mishteh? So I would argue, to appreciate the tzom in Megillat Esther, you have to appreciate a tzom in the Hebrew Bible. What does a tzom in the Hebrew Bible look like? Yeah, I know we don't eat and we don't drink and the rest of it, but that's just the trappings, as it were. A tzom in the Hebrew Bible, without exception, is always about tshuva. It's always about securing God's favor or God's forgiveness. Always. And when I say always, what I mean is whenever a fast is reported in the Hebrew Bible, that's how it's reported. The people cried out to God, the people returned to God, and God relented. So here we have an anomaly, as it were, and maybe it is the ultimate anomaly in the Megillah. If there is a moment in the story when God should have been introduced, thank you, that was the moment. Okay? The moment of the tzom. A 3-day fast is a huge deal. And yet God isn't mentioned. Right? So we have Mishteh. And frankly, I don't expect God to make an appearance in the Mishteh, just by nature of how it's experienced. And we have a tzom right in the middle of the Mishta'ot. That's the moment for introducing God to the story. And yet, he's nowhere to be found. Which leads me to conclude the following. The problem with Megillat Esther is not the omission of God's name. The problem with Megillat Esther is the deliberate deletion of God's name. I.e., whoever is writing the story is deliberately writing God out of the story, not just forgetting to include him. Okay, so it's even more serious than Ibn Ezra imagined. He thought this was a technical issue. Well, it's going to be translated in the Persians. We don't want them to substitute God's name and the rest of it. It's a much more serious problem than that. Whoever is writing this is deliberately writing God out of the story. And that's the proof that the fast in the midst of the feasts, which is the ultimate moment to introduce God to the story, leaves him out. I want to turn to the Ramban. The Ramban is on the final pages of the source sheet, 4 and 5. And once again, the Ramban calls our attention to the curious fact that somewhere along the line of Jewish history, the months that were numbers become months that are names. Now, he's not talking about Megillat Esther at all. He's just pointing out that feature of the biblical landscape. Right? So when the lunar calendar, the lunar solar calendar is introduced in Sefer Shemot, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim, and the rest of it, the first of months will be the month of the Exodus. The Ramban points out that that particular system isn't forever, because when the Jews go into exile and then return, they will bring back the names of the Babylonian and Persian and Assyrian deities as the names of their months. And this is what he has to say. Not going to read the whole thing, just the part on page 5. Hasibah bazeh. The reason is, I'm on the second line on page 5. Ki mitchila haya minyanam zecher liyitziat Mitzrayim. The months initially just being ordinal numbers were a conscious attempt to commemorate the Exodus and place it at the center of our Jewish identity. When we count the months, the first month, the second month, the third month, and we understand that that means from the moment of the Exodus, that indicates the Exodus, the redemption, is at the core of our identity. And in fact, it is. Certainly in the Hebrew Bible, the Exodus is the pivotal moment. Aval kasher alinu mi bavel, v'nitkayem ma she'amar hakatuv, lo ye'amer od chai Hashem asher he'elat b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim, ki im chai Hashem asher he'elav asher hevi b'nei Yisrael me'eretz tzafon, chazarnu likroa chodashim b'shem sh'nikraim be'eretz bavel, lehazkir ki sham amadnu, u'misham he'elanu Hashem yitbarach. What a novel interpretation of the phenomenon. Ramban says, as much as we commemorate the first redemption, the Exodus, by employing months that are cardinal numbers, that reminds us of that redemption called the Exodus from Egypt, by employing names that we bring back from Babylon, we commemorate the second redemption, the redemption from Babylon, which is also a moment of Geula. Ki ela hashemot nisan niyar vezulatam shemot parsiim. These names are Persian names. They're only found in the prophets who prophesied during the period of the exile to Babylon. Zechariah, Ezra, Nehemiah, Megillat Esther. V'lachein amar katuv b'chodesh harishon hu chodesh nisan, quoting the Megillah. Why does the Megillah say the first month, that is the month of Nisan? Kimo hipil pur hu hagoral. Just like the Megillah has the need to translate the word pur, which is a Persian word, that is to say the goral, the lot, so too, Nisan, that is to say the first month. What's the Ramban saying? Fundamentally, what the Ramban is saying is that just as we commemorate the Exodus from Egypt by introducing names to the months that will remind us of that event and its centrality, so too we commemorate the Exodus from Babylon, so to speak, the redemption and the restoration to Zion, by introducing names that pertain to that experience. So it's a beautiful idea. The Ramban is able to detect in the story of the restoration to Zion, in the story of leaving the Babylonian exile, a redemptive story. It's a story of Geula. And he'll leave it at that. But I want us to appreciate what he's also saying by implication. If it is the case that we commemorate the redemption from Babylon by using names which are Assyrian and Babylonian and Persian, what that is essentially saying is the redemption from Babylon is qualitatively different from the Exodus from Egypt. The Exodus from Egypt was a story in which the people of Israel secured their freedom and their liberty, physical and spiritual, from their Egyptian taskmasters. And so whatever Egypt was about was left behind completely. And we introduced a new way of keeping time, the first month, the second month, the third month, because the Exodus was the moment when we broke free. It shares nothing with our Egyptian past. It looks entirely towards the future and does so in quote unquote an authentically Jewish way. But the redemption from Babylon was nothing like that, because the Jews were only able to leave as a result of the fact that the Persians gave them permission. And even as they returned to Jerusalem and rebuilt the temple, They did so under the aegis of the Persian kings. It's Cyrus who allows them to go forth. It's Darius Daryavish who allows the rebuilding of the temple. And throughout the period of the Persian kings, the Jewish people, even those in Jerusalem, are subject to their rule. What the Ramban is really saying is, the reason why we commemorate this second exodus by employing names that are Persian and Babylonian and Assyrian in origin is because that's the nature, the sad nature, as it were, of that redemptive moment. It had none of the glory of the Exodus. The Exodus was the 10 plagues. That's another 10, by the way. The Exodus was the splitting of the sea. The Exodus was miracles left and right. The Exodus was God front and center. And leaving Babylon was the Persian kings, securing their permission somehow, being allowed to proceed and fighting tooth and nail to get their approval for building the temple and for constructing a second Jewish commonwealth. So it's only appropriate that the names that we employ not only indicate that it was a redemptive moment, but also indicate the limits of that redemption. There was nothing overt. There was nothing miraculous. There was no divine intervention to speak of. At least not explicit in the story of the return to Zion. So in essence, what the Ramban is arguing is, it's entirely appropriate that we employ the names of the months that recall our exile in Babylon, because we're still there, so to speak. We may have been restored to Jerusalem, but we were not restored to our former glory. We may have been able to reconstruct the temple, but we were not able to acquire independence in the way that we enjoyed it the first time around. And so the names of the months that we now employ reflect that fact. That's what the Ramban is saying through implication. Another way to put it is, what happens along the Jewish timeline is some sort of a transformation of the story of God's intervention in human history. If the Exodus is about overt intervention, the Megillah is not. If the Exodus is about miracles, the Megillah is about political intrigue and personal ambition. If the Exodus is about the Jewish people understanding their identity in the most profound way, the Megillah is about confusion. Are we Jews or are we Persians? Or are we both? So essentially what I'm arguing is, there's a very conscious reason why God's name is not mentioned in the story. And it's not because somebody forgot to put him in there. It's because the author of the Megillah is reflecting upon the new reality. And that new reality is a reality of God's presence being eclipsed. God being absent. God being silent. Which is, by the way, the default version of the story in Jewish history. It's the Exodus which is the exception. If you look at the sweep of Jewish history, it's primarily a Purim story and not a Pesach story. Which is another way of saying, whatever the message of the Megillah is, at the end of the day, it's going to be the critical message for the Jewish people as they make their way through human history. Remember, we saw last week, the Gemara argued, there were many prophets in ancient Israel, but only that which was required for posterity was recorded as a text and incorporated into the Hebrew Bible. And at the time I pointed out, yes, Megillat Esther is a critical message in the Hebrew Bible because it introduces the new reality. That's the transition moment. As God, as it were, retreats into the shadows and human history unfolds without his involvement. But I want to suggest to you that although it appears to be a story of divine absence, it's actually not. And the author of the Megillah was very careful to alert us. The cues are there. Whenever we reach a point in the story, we know as informed readers of the Tanakh, that's a moment where God should have appeared. Whether it's the election of Esther, or whether it's Mordechai's plea, or whether it's Esther's presentation to the king, or whether it's the two feasts, whatever the case may be, that's a moment where the informed reader appreciates and realizes God's presence should have been noted. I want to share with you a striking feature of the Megillah. And I don't know who the first one to note it is, but it's very dramatic. You may be aware of it, you may not. If I were to ask you, considering the theme of redemption, who are the least likely candidates in the story to be advancing a redemptive process? Who are the people in the story that are least likely to have any inkling that in fact what might be happening here is a deliberate divine design? Who are the least likely candidates in the story for that? What would you say? Haman? Chashverosh? Yeah. But I'd say these two in particular, because they're just so ungodly from beginning to end, right? Literally every event in the Megillah that gives us some sort of an insight into their character makes it clear that they're not devotees of God on any level, okay? If I were to ask you, what is the least likely context for redemption to unfold in Megillat Esther, it would be a mishte. That's the place where you are least likely to find God. Right? What goes on at a mishte in the Megillah? Drunkenness, frivolity, lewdness. I mean, everything that you can imagine. You're not going to find God at a mishte. Certainly not glut kosher food, right? So, interestingly enough, there's a verse in the Megillah that draws together all three of these things very, very tightly. And coincidentally, it's actually Esther's first invitation to her first feast. Chapter 5. Verse number 4. If it's fitting in the eyes of the king, if I have found favor in his eyes, may the king and Haman join me at the feast that I have made for them. Right? Yavo Hamelech v'Haman Hayom El Hamishte Asher Asiti Lahem. So it's a dramatic feature, and of course, we're sort of left wondering: is that coincidence? Is that deliberate? So for me, the answer is clear. Obviously, it's deliberate. It's a deliberate move by the author of the text to introduce the presence of God to the story and unleash the process of redemption through the least likely candidates at the least likely venue. Because that's what it means when God retreats behind the veil of human history. It's not that he's not involved. It's not that he doesn't care. It's not that he's absent from the story. In fact, what it is an opportunity for the human beings in the story to take the initiative. So the changed condition ushered in by the redemption from Babylon, as it were, moving away from the first month to the month of Nisan, moving away from the Exodus, overt divine intervention, to covert divine intervention, is marked by this moment in the story. God is there, but you're going to have to look for him to find him. God is involved, but that involvement is muted and understated. The Jews will survive, and the divine plan will be realized, but exactly the direction that it takes will neither be obvious nor clear. What's the power of God's retreat from human history? As much as God retreats, human beings have an opportunity to act. Because frankly, there's not a lot of room for human beings to act in an Exodus moment. The most Moshe can do is lift up his staff, frankly. That's the extent of his involvement. But Megillat Esther asks us to take a stand. It's Esther, the most heroic figure in the story, who makes the most fateful decision. And her decision will carry the day. So even as God retreats, human beings have an opportunity to act. And by the way, that is the reality of our present day predicament. Maybe it's not a predicament after all. Maybe it's just potential for us to make the right decision. The rabbis say the following, Remez le'Esther, min ha-Torah minayin. What is the allusion in the Torah to the story of Esther? You have the source in front of you. I forget if it was this week or last week. A verse from the end of Sefer Devarim. Va'anochi, says God, I will haster astir panai. I will surely hide my face on that day. Even as the Jewish people suffer the tribulations of exile, and God appears to be hidden, or absent, or silent, or unconcerned, the rabbis say, Haster astir panai, that is Esther. It's not astart, it's hiddenness. That's precisely the point. Esther represents the hiddenness of God in the story. The hiddenness of God in the story is her opportunity to act. And so in essence, Haster astir panai is Esther, and Megillat Esther is the story of taking initiative as God leaves us the room to do so. And so in effect, we've come full circle. We got to end because it's late. Okay, my instructions were an hour and a quarter, not a minute more because people get tired. I'm getting tired too, frankly. It's late. Okay, so if I were to draw all of this together, I would say we've seen a text and we've seen a holiday which are fundamentally different than anything else in Jewish tradition. We've seen a Megillah which is shorn of God's name and seemingly of his involvement. And at the same time, we've appreciated that God's absence or seeming absence from the story is actually just illusory, a masquerade, as it were, a mask, if you want to think about it that way. Because behind the scenes, as human beings make heroic decisions, God is constantly involved, guiding the events to a redemptive conclusion. And that's the essential message of Megillat Esther and of the Festival of Purim. And we can readily appreciate why that message is so critical for Jewish history. Because like I said earlier, if you examine the broad sweep of Jewish history, you will discover that more often than not, we're not talking about Pesach. We're talking about Purim. Thank you.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.